auditorium here so that we can work out better with the microphones. We're now ready to proceed with our pre-launch briefing for the Apollo 12 mission. We're aiming toward our planned T-0 at 11:22 a.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow morning. I'd like to introduce the gentlemen here at the Kennedy Space Center. We also have two gentlemen standing by at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. From your left, we have Donald K. Slayton, who is Director of Flight Crew Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. Charles Berry, Director of Medical Research and Operations at MSC. Mr. Osro Covington, who is Assistant Director for Manned Space Flight Support at the Goddard Space Flight Center. Captain Chet Lee, who is the Apollo Mission Director, Office of Manned Space Flight, NASA Headquarters. Rocco A. Patrone, who is Apollo Program Director, Office of Manned Space Flight, NASA Headquarters. Mr. Walter Caprian, who is Director of Launch Operations here at the Kennedy Space Center. Mr. Roy Godfrey, who is Director of Saturn Operations at the Marshall Space Flight Center. And Colonel Royce Olson, who is Director of the Department of Defense Manned Space Flight Support at Patrick Air Force Base. Standing by in Houston, we have Mr. Christopher Kraft, who is Director of Flight Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center, and Mr. Jerry Griffin, the Flight Director at MSC. Before proceeding to cover some logistics quickly, we will be open all night tonight. We'll be around the clock, 24 hours, at the News Center in Cape Canaveral. There'll be information available there on the status of buses, transportation, and so forth. And one head that hit it away from me, and I apologize, is Jim McDivitt, of course, who is the Apollo Program Manager at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. Excuse me, Jim. Mr. Patron?
I'd like to mention that with the Apollo 12 mission, we start a new phase of Apollo. Apollo 11 demonstrated that we could land and return successfully from the moon. With Apollo 12, we now start the exploitation of this system we've developed in the name of science and knowledge to bring back this information, leave experiments on the moon, bring back those things that we have spent much time in the ensuing months since 11 determining was needed to give us, you might say, the capability of exploiting and exploring the moon. Now, we must not lose sight, although there's a great stress on the work we're going to do on the moon and the knowledge we're going to bring back, that this is still risky business, that the margins for error are still as small as they ever were. The fact that we've done it once means we can do it, but each time, the same risks are there. Now, we've balanced off these risks against the objectives. We have a more ambitious mission on 12 based on the fact we feel we can pull it off. We can do it. But the thing we must keep in mind, the fact that flying to the moon, returning safely, is still a very demanding business, has its risks. We have weighed the risks and the trade-offs with our returns. And we're confident we step to Apollo 12 and subs, that we have kept in the foreground at all times. The balance of risks and returns we expect from the mission. That's all I have, Jet.
Go ahead, Jet.
Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, the LH-2 Lang, the tank that gave us the problem, has been replaced. Both the LOX and liquid hydrogen have been loaded, and at this time, conditions are all go. Now, the failure analysis of the tank is continuing. The leak has been repeated in the malfunction lab under ambient conditions and has been isolated to the manifold section. This, as I repeat again, the analysis is still continuing. We don't know the actual cause of the failure. As far as the count goes, the count is holding at the present time at T-minus 17 hours until the pad is opened. The launch vehicle is essentially sitting, waiting until the pad is open, and they will pick up their regular countdown sequences. The spacecraft, in the meantime, during this hold, is proceeding to do their mechanical breakup and so forth to get clear of the area. Now, our plan is to pick up as soon as we can on T-minus 17 and count down to T-minus 9 hours. Depending on how soon we pick up the count will determine how much of a hold that we will have at this time. It may be 1 hour, maybe 2 hours, could be more, depending on how well things go at this time. We are also expecting to include a built-in hold of 1 hour at T-minus 3 1/2 hours in the count. As far as weather goes, prediction is that we will have a front pass through. We expect scattered showers this evening or tonight, and there is a distinct possibility that tomorrow we will have low clouds, some showers at launch time, and winds probably around 20 knots from the north or slightly west of north. One final item, we have decided, because of the problem that developed yesterday and the decision was made that we would not try for the backup site on the 16th, to give us a greater opportunity of making the launch on the 14th, to expand the launch window. We have increased the azimuth. Actions have been taken so that we can now, if necessary, go to 106 degrees for launch azimuth. This will give us an approximately an hour and 20 minutes additional window for the liftoff. That's it.
We in the Department of Defense have accommodated to this expanded launch window that Chet just mentioned. We have moved the Vanguard a little bit south from her present position, 180 miles approximately. The range is ready from a range safety standpoint to accommodate 72 to 106 degrees as far as any supporting radars. We are working with MSC Houston to come up with the final disposition of the Araya aircraft, the Apollo Range Instrumentation aircraft, so that we can cover this expanded possibility of a TLI, the transmitter injection burn position. So we will be in a position to accommodate to this change. I might support Mr. Patron to say it is a sort of a new era for the DOD support as well, through mutual agreements and increased confidence in this type of operation. We in the DOD are supporting for the first time under 6,000 people for a manned flight. In other words, starting from Mercury to this one, this is the lowest number of Department of Defense support of any mission, and I think that this is great, because if we're going to continue this type of business, we've got to do it without calling up a lot of extra people. So I think we're making great progress. We have 5,900 people, 52 aircraft, and 7 ships. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Colonel. I guess we're now ready to proceed with questions at this time. We will have to restrict this conference, the question period, to about 45 minutes. Two of these gentlemen will have to board a helicopter to catch a plane to get back to Houston, so we will have to time our conference concerned with their travel departure. We're now ready for questions. If we have a couple of gentlemen for those microphones there, please. Could a couple of you handle the mics? We would appreciate it so that they can hear the questions in Houston. Right up there in the back.
Will TLI be covered in all cases, including the 106-degree launch azimuth? Will there be any critical portions of the Earth orbital phase that we have been told will be covered that can't be if the launch goes late?
All critical portions will be covered.
Over here, George.
What is the end of the launch window now, the latter part of the launch window?
I don't have that. Could you go on another question and I'll see if I can...
We'll come up with that. We'll have to do a little addition here. Up in front. Mr. Pip.
What is the weather minimum that you can... For how low can the clouds be, and what winds can you tolerate?
As far as the cloud coverage is concerned, for launch site recovery, in the event we should have an abort, the restriction is 500 feet. As far as winds are concerned, the winds for we have two things we have to concern ourselves with. Number one, should the wind situation be such that in the event we had to have a pad abort and a and if a landing was predicted for the spacecraft, we are restricted by 54 foot per second maximum horizontal velocity for the spacecraft. And that wind restriction can be as low as 25 knots under certain conditions and can go considerably higher. As far as the structural constraints for the vehicle are concerned, the constraint would be 47 knots.
Over here. Somebody needs to press the button, I'm sorry. There we go.
All right. On the lunar landing itself, has the fuel capacity, I asked this question last time, but has the fuel capacity in the descent stage of the lunar module been increased in case a computer override should take place as was on Apollo 11?
Yes, we have increased the fuel capacity in the descent propulsion system. We really haven't made the tanks any larger, and it hasn't come as a result of any computer problems. It was just that as a result of some continuing testing that we've been doing, we found that the ullage volume required at the top of the tanks was greater. We had more than was really required. We decreased the ullage volume from about 2 cubic feet to 1 cubic foot. This gave us an increase of a couple hundred pounds of propellant when you add up the 4 tanks, so that we really have more fuel available for use on this flight than we did on the preceding one.
Was there any special reason why you didn't train this crew for the landing site that you would have to use if you had started on Sunday instead? I mean, all of a sudden it seems to, when you come in here, that you've discovered that you couldn't land on Sunday.
Yes, we didn't have time, primarily. But there's a few factors that go into that we probably ought to explain. The decision to land at the prime site was made after Apollo 11 landed. And the work involved in getting the geology traverses worked out, the exact details of what we wanted to do at this site, the maps and et cetera, just took a lot more time than anybody expected, and we did not, in fact, have time to get this stuff prepared in time to train the crew for the backup site. It's about that simple.
Go ahead, John.
Did you know that this was coming up when you picked the alternate time, the Sunday date? Did you know you weren't going to be prepared at that point?
Yeah, I think so.
And why was the alternate included to begin with?
I can't answer that question.
Let me answer that. The alternate was picked because we were going to attempt to have a site to recycle to. When the decision was made in July to go to Site 7, the work started, the priority had to go into that. And so in terms of getting maps and planning and so forth, we were working toward the backup site, but those maps and all took second priority. We got into the training cycle. It was only within really about the last month we saw that from the training cycle we were learning many things against this pinpoint landing technique. And it comes that when you evaluate your next mission, Apollo 13, where we want to go to Fra Mauro, we then saw we had to have demonstrated a pinpoint landing technique, not just land on the moon. We could go to the backup site to land, deploy ALSEP, and do those things. The geology traverses would not have been worked out in the detail that they have for 12. But the demonstration of the pinpoint landing technique, in order to commit later for Apollo 13 and Fra Mauro, was then the big point, and then became the deciding point as we assessed it here yesterday, that we could land safely. We just don't have confidence we could demonstrate a technique of landing to a point that we want to do on 12 in order to allow us to go to the site we now have selected for Fra Mauro for 13.
I think that's the point we ought to make clear, is that we could, in fact, go to the alternate site if we wanted to. We just didn't have enough background on it to feel that it was really worth it at this point in time to get full advantage out of the mission. It could be done safely.
Dan, partner, back here.
Well, what will be the situation on Apollo 13? Will you be able to be ready for the backup site on that?
Let me address that, even though it's not germane to 12. For the first month on 13, we are now looking at only committing to the one site. You see, as we go into the exploration phase of the moon now, and you set sites for yourself and plans, If you start jostling sites at which you land, it becomes very difficult then to follow an orderly process through the sites we plan to go to. So our plan now, one we looked at just about 2 weeks ago, Apollo 13, on the first month of availability, would be from our, and assuming that decision sticks after we review the 12 data, we would not plan a backup the first month. The second month, we would. Now, you might ask why. This gets into hypergol lifetime, storage time on the bird. The bird's been fueled about a month. You see, we've got some 2.5 months of lifetime of seals and gaskets and things that would hypergol in. So now when we come up against Frau Mauro a second time, let's say for some reason, winds, we have to cancel the first time. We then plan to wait a month. Now the second time, there we want to have an alternate to go to. So if we do have to slip 1 or 2 days or 3 days, we can launch with a spacecraft which have been fueled almost 2 months now and feel safe with our seals and gaskets and things that are in there exposed to hypergols since they're loaded with hypergols. Now, we're going to have to look at each one of these individually. It very much ties in with your future sites you're going to. And since the name of the game is to get the maximum return here for science and laying out ALSEPs and things, we probably would in the future have single sites we go to and only use the backup. When you come to the time that if you lost it there, you're not going to launch that ship. Then we go to the backup.
Over here.
Since you don't know precisely what happened to the first hydrogen tank, what precautions have been made to see that the second tank don't suffer the same weaknesses?
We reviewed the data on this particular tank that we've taken out. We don't know exactly where the leak is precisely. It could be between two stainless steel parts or between a stainless steel and titanium part. We know which portion of the tank it's in. We haven't taken any special precautions on the other tanks that would be different than any other set of tanks that we've looked at. However, these tanks go through a long history of testing and that lead us up to the point that we can fill them. Initial thinking at this time is that we had some results of the inflow of the cold cryogenics or the cooling down so that we had some thermal stress that was applied to the tank. Now, since we've already loaded and taken this thermal shock on the other tanks, we feel that they're all right. But we have to go ahead and find out exactly what the problem is. And when we look at this particular piece, which is the inlet manifold of the tank, and we're sectioning it right now, when we determine exactly what the cause was, then we'll know whether we're all right on the other tanks.
Will you go ahead and have this determination made before the launch tomorrow morning?
I think that we will. Yes, we're in the process right now. We've removed from the top of the tank this particular manifold. It's the wells are being cut off at the present time. We should be able to leak test it in just another hour or so. We know where the leak is within about a quarter of an inch, and the only thing that we have to determine is whether the leak is between two stainless steel parts which are welded together, or a piece of titanium and a piece of steel which are cold extruded and sort of make a very close form fit. Once we determine that, then we'll know better about what the problem is.
John?
Has there been any change in this tank from the ones that have flown before, or are you flying with identical tanks this time?
No, this is the same kind of tank. It's a Block 2 tank. We changed the tanks quite some time ago, back in the days of Spacecraft 20, before we entered into the manned portion of the Apollo program. This is a Block 2 tank. The only significant change between Block 1 and Block 2 tanks is we took out some titanium lines and replaced them with stainless steel. This particular tank has the stainless steel lines in it. There's no significant difference between this and any of the other tanks.
We've got some questions way back up there. Why don't you start walking back up, Ken? Do we have one here while he makes the trip up? Ken? Okay, fine.
I have a very general question. This mission has been described as being much more complex, but also much more dangerous than Apollo 11. Would you consider that an accurate statement?
I don't believe the words here today. You're not referring to my words earlier? No. Because I said there are risks. I'd weigh the risks to be the same.
See, more dangerous than 11... we're going to be on the moon a longer period of time. We're going to have EVA a longer period of time. But I think in assessing those risks, we have to classify about the same as 11. So I would not draw the conclusion it's more risky than 11. I would draw the conclusion it's the same order of risk.
Mr. Muller, back up there.
To Rocco or Mr. Caprian, please. You both have stressed that we're go on the tank. Did you have any minor problem with the first stage of the booster today?
No, we had no problem with the first stage of the booster. We did have a problem with the second stage in that we had an instrumentation problem. A defect became apparent with our PCM package. That package has been removed, replaced, and has been retested. That is the only stage problem that we've had in the last 24 hours.
Chana?
Dr. Barry, the crew appears to be pretty hot to go here. Formation aerobatics on the day before. You want to fill us in briefly on how you feel about the crew status this morning, condition, physical, and everything?
Well, the crew has been looked at daily, and they're in excellent condition. We don't have any concerns about their medical status at all, Rick. Fine shape.
The weather forecast that you gave for tomorrow and the weather minimums that were given seem fairly close. Is there any real concern about the weather, and what percentage would you place on the chances of a scrub for weather?
Well, we're going to have to play that one by ear, of course. As you know, this business of predicting the weather is kind of an art rather than a science, and I'm in constant touch with the weather office, and we feel quite confident that the conditions aren't going to be as nice as we'd like them to be, but we think we're going to be within our minimums.
Dr. Barry, is the crew planning any special activity to prevent any disorientation or sickness that we saw on earlier missions, not on 11? Head exercises, anything like that during the flight?
Negative. We have determined that the single instance that we did that on Apollo 10, that we don't really know we don't have enough data from that to really know the value of that as a procedure, and what we did on Apollo 11 is what will be done on 12, where they will cautiously do their initial activity, and that worked very well, and we expect it to do the same on this flight.
Dr. Barry, what are some of the major physical changes that have been noticed per se in flights with the astronauts other than rising blood pressure and this type of thing, just out of curiosity?
You mean what sort of things have we seen on any of the flights?
Gee whiz.
You want to start at the beginning? Well, the things that have been seen in Apollo that have been very similar to what we had experienced earlier in the Gemini flight, in that we have seen some cardiovascular deconditioning, we've seen some minimal loss of calcium, we've seen some minimal loss of exercise capacity. All of these things have been changes which have returned to normal within a period of 24 to 48 hours post-flight. And we think these are adaptive phenomena, that where the body is adapting to a less demanding zero-G environment, and then they readapt again during this 48-hour period post-flight to a situation here on the ground. The only thing that's taken a little bit longer, just because the process takes longer, is the replacement of the calcium.
What I was specifically, I'm sorry to make it more clear, but what I was more interested in was as far as Apollo 11 and when they actually landed on the moon. This is what I should have said.
Well, we saw nothing specific on 11 that we hadn't seen in other flights. Now, the one thing that was important to us from 11 that has been very helpful, of course, in planning 12 and future lunar exploration missions has been the ability to work in the 1/6G environment. And we were able to get very good data during the lunar surface time on the last mission. We feel that we've refined that capability somewhat since that mission, and we expect to get very good data again using utilizing heart rate in calibrated crewmen, and then also using the temperature of the water-cooled undergarment, the water that goes in and out, and the oxygen usage, and then we're going to have
measurements made after the first EVA of the amount of feed water that was left. And with this information, we feel that we'll, again, get a bigger handle on exactly what this energy cost is in this environment. And it looks to be just about exactly what we had anticipated from the simulations before the last flight, which is contrary to what we had seen in the Gemini EVA experience. So we're very, very happy with that whole situation.
I think Chet Lee wanted to make a comment at this point. And then following that, I think we ought to see if your colleagues in Houston have any questions. We'll then come back here. Chet?
I'd like to clear up a possible misconception of the weather, that we'll be close to weather minimums. If my weather report, which was scattered showers and some low clouds, indicated that in winds of 20 knots, I would like to emphasize that this does not put us close to minimums. Scattered showers, we could be perfectly clear over the launch area. Winds 20 knots, we've had before.
Did you time that?
Just timed that perfectly. Probably it's clear in the launch area. I know I've been out at the VAB, and it's been raining, and halfway between the VAB and the pad, the rain edge stopped, and it was perfectly clear at the pad. So by no means do we consider at this time we'll be close to weather minimum.
And the more of it we see this afternoon, the better we'll feel for tomorrow.
Okay, let's switch for a while here to Houston. Do we have any questions from the news media at Houston, please?
Given for the landing ellipse, how long is the landing ellipse in which they may land?
I assume you're talking about on the lunar. Are you talking lunar surface, or are you talking about recovery?
The size of the lunar surface landing ellipse.
Guys in Houston can answer that one, but it's, we hope 1 kilometer circle is what we're aiming for.
The right answer is that we really don't have any ellipse in this particular area. Again, this area is not too different from where we landed on Apollo 11. And as far as constraining the landing to any particular point, we've not done that. What we're attempting to do is see how accurately we can land this vehicle with the navigation changes that we've made and the updates that we're making during the descent. And we hope that we will be within several hundred feet of the landing point. Now, our Monte Carlo analysis has shown us that a 3 sigma error is something like 8,000 to 9,000 feet.
Downrange. Plus or minus.
Could they land 8,000 to 9,000 feet?
Yes, without any trouble at all.
How far downrange could they land? Is there a point beyond which they could not land?
Repeat your question, please, Lee.
How far downrange could they land from the optimum target point?
In terms of their ability to land on that particular part of the moon, within the capabilities of the propellant we have available to the LEM, there is no place that they could not land in the general vicinity of the point in which we're going.
Those numbers that we're talking about there are an automatic entry with no manual takeover. Now, of course, he could be 4,000 or 5,000 feet off, and our simulation has shown that he can take over manually and fly that out. So the ellipse really shrinks once you put the crewman in the loop.
I'd like to get it straight in my mind, either from Chris or from somebody in Florida, why it is that if you knew all along that you weren't going to use the second day or take advantage of the alternate landing site, you went through all this charade of telling us about it.
Could I get into this one?
The truth of the matter is that we had hoped, as we planned Apollo 12, to have a true backup site. As pointed out in Florida, however, as we got the desire to get this pinpoint landing, and as we planned over the last few months, Bill, the lunar program, we began to see that Apollo 12 was a very key flight in order to make those necessary plans for future flights. And so we began to aim in or set our sights and our goals more on this pinpoint landing. Now, as we did that, it required a great deal of work on the parts of the map services people. We've utilized this terrain map, which the crew has been training with, which has been very important to the recognition of landmarks as they approach the landing site and use the redesignate capability we had. Now, that really, frankly, was our, as Rocco put it very well, was the real point in deciding yesterday that we didn't want to go to Apollo
Site 5. Now, there are other reasons, and that is that since we've been spending all our time and effort now, we found out over the last few weeks that we really weren't prepared from the point of view of landmark sightings, et cetera, to go to Site 5. We could have gone, but we just did not think it was proper in the context of what we've got ahead of us.
Well, to follow that up, I understood from what Rocco said earlier that it was quite some time ago that you decided to drop Site 5 out of your planning. When actually did Site 5 disappear?
No, let me correct that point.
Purpose from your planning, just yesterday?
I think it seemed to ahead yesterday, Bill, when we were faced with the decision of really where are we going to go to Site 5. I think we probably could have made the decision a couple of weeks ago when we found that we really didn't have the mapping and the things that we needed to make a pinpoint landing. Now, I think that what would happen, for instance, it's between now and December. Suppose we scrub tomorrow. The crew will spend a great deal of time between now and that time in studying Site 5, and we will work a lot harder on it and coming up with the flight plans and the timelines to do that, so that we will probably spend, say, two-thirds of our time in the next 30 days studying Site 5.
I think it's a little more real basic
I'd like
thing
to hear
here.
That a little further. Site 5 was one of the original designated Apollo program landing sites, and presumably way back was one of the prime areas at which lunar orbiters and rangers and that sort of thing looked and made decisions.